You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the latest episode of the City of Man podcast. This is Edward Song. I am an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California, and I am joined, as always, by Coyle Neal, who is an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. How's it going, Coyle?
It's going pretty well. How are you, Ed?
I'm doing well. You and I haven't sort of recorded traditional just one-on-one podcasts in a goodly while, you and me.
It's been, what, since our post-inauguration episode when it was just the two of us?
Yeah, something like that. I have to say that since that we've recorded a few episodes with other people, I myself have been kind of burned out. I was following the political goings-ons and happenings really intensely up until the election and a couple weeks after the election. And then I have to say, like, I just got completely burned out of all of that stuff and haven't been keeping tabs much of what's going on. How about you?
You know, I worry sometimes that I should be paying more attention, but I have a newborn at home and this full-time job, and we just got over a bout with the flu, so I don't maybe feel as bad as I should about not paying attention. But no, I'm also not following as closely as I probably should, especially as a political scientist.
Yeah, and so we have other things that we want to get to in this episode, but do you have quick thoughts on the... So Donald Trump has been in office for just... Despite how it might feel, it's been just over a month since he's been in office. Do you have thoughts on the reign of Trump so far?
Yeah, we've had this flurry of sort of executive orders and executive actions, and I was really worried about those. And then I remembered back to some of the things that you had said during our presidency and wedding cakes episodes, and you had assured me that executive orders were perfectly fine and there's nothing wrong with them and that's just the president's job. So I was like, oh, well, I guess they must be fine. And I assume you're also okay with all of the executive orders that President Trump has issued.
Well, I mean, I don't question.
Maybe the sarcasm wasn't dripping off of my voice enough.
No, it was pretty well dripping. I mean, the question that I have doesn't have to do with his authority to issue them so much as it does the content or their aims.
But I mean, if you have a problem with the content, you just file a lawsuit, right? I mean, that's
only if he's abused his authority. You know, so even on the so I think the immigration ban is abhorrent. But I don't even know necessarily that, like, that's a violation of his powers of the executive. Like, I have no idea on that.
And again, I have not had time to actually pay attention to the debates on them. What with the semester starting and the new kiddo at home and all that, I just don't. It's been interesting, probably more than anything, watching some of the reactions on social media, watching some of the various things that friends have been saying. But even then, I don't have time to pay attention.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have to say, I haven't seen a lot of conservative... Yeah, so maybe you're not in a position to answer this since you haven't sort of been really with your ear to the ground. But I haven't heard a lot of, like, conservative, like, classical conservative reaction to Trump's policies so much. I wasn't sure if there was any kind of if conservatives in the United States are generally pleased or they're ambivalent or they're upset about everything that's happened.
Yeah, and again, I think you basically have to go sort of issue by issue. So I've seen I saw that the senator from Nebraska that all of the old school conservatives like Ben Sasse had praised the Department of Education pick. Had praised Betsy DeVos. Not necessarily as an administrative pick, but for her work and her service and so on, which I thought was interesting. But I've also seen people sort of across the board condemn, you know, Ben Carson as head of housing and urban development. Mm-hmm. And again, I think it just depends.
Conservatives doing that. On what basis? Just because he wasn't qualified, or
I mean, by his own admission, he was not qualified. You know, a week or so before he got the nomination, he came out publicly and said, "I'm not qualified."
Yeah.
But the few things I have been paying attention to have basically all been focused on the courts. So decisions that have been coming out of circuit courts that are heading and district courts that are heading towards the Supreme Court. So there's a decision in a Washington State Court over, I forget if it was a baker or a florist in a gay marriage thing. So that will be moving towards the Supreme Court.
It was a woman, I think, right?
Yeah, an older lady.
Yeah.
And then there's a circuit court decision that I was reading a little bit about. I want to say it was the Fourth Circuit had made a decision about gun control. But again, these are all tangential to what most people are paying attention to out of the Trump administration. And I haven't had time to keep up. So
yeah,
sorry, listeners, Professor Fail.
Well, you've had a lot going on, and
I'm lazy. So let's throw that in too. That's a lot of work, Ed.
You and I are coming up to a 1-year anniversary. I don't know when we started this podcast back on April 11th of 2016, if either of us were quite sure whether we'd be doing this at this time next year. But in any case, we are coming up to our 1-year anniversary. To that end, Coyle and I wanted to do an Ask Me Anything episode. That is try to – Coyle and I will have questions for each other, but we wanted to especially solicit questions from our listeners. Whatever questions have been building up over the last year of podcasts on specific subjects, or even questions that you've had that have just sort of arisen, we'd love to take an episode and field those questions. So again, our anniversary is officially in like a month and a half, I guess. So over the next few weeks, please do shoot us an email, whatever question you have been dying to ask Professor Neil or myself. We would be happy to address them. And as always, you can send those questions to our email address, which is just cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com, or you can go ahead and put them up on our Facebook page, which you can find at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. But our topic, so our topic today is abortion. Abortion is a perennial issue of great moral concern in our country. It continues to be. During this last election, certainly a lot of people who were not otherwise inclined to vote for Donald Trump voted for him purely on the basis of the Supreme Court nominee who they thought he was likely to nominate, and the kinds of rulings that were anticipated on the question of abortion. Abortion remains one of the great moral issues that we confront in contemporary society, and it remains a defining political issue. So Coyle and I wanted to turn our attention to that today. So we thought we would start off by talking a little bit about the history and politics of abortion over the... Well, certainly since Roe v. Wade, and then even including before Roe v. Wade in 1973, I guess. So, Coyle, why don't you kick us off on that history review?
Yeah, I mean, obviously Roe v. Wade is the big line here, right? It's the breakpoint in the issue. Prior to Roe v. Wade, abortion was a state by state issue, and I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it's something like 39 states had some kind of laws banning abortion in the United States prior to 1973, which also means because this was such a state-by-state issue, how many abortions were there in the United States prior to 1973 is functionally an unanswerable question. Like, we don't know. If you see numbers cited somewhere on the internet or wherever, they're probably just made up. That's not to say there are no numbers, but because it's illegal so many places, the reporting is usually pretty inaccurate. Along comes Roe versus Wade, which is, I don't know how detailed we want to get into the background of the case there, but it's basically based on a prior case called Griswold versus Connecticut that comes out in the 60s. Griswold versus Connecticut had argued that we all as Americans have the right to privacy. where does this right to privacy come from? You know, you read the Constitution, there's no statement saying Americans have the right to privacy. You know, Congress shall make no law abridging your right to privacy is not a statement you will find. What Griswold says is that your right to privacy is found in the penumbras and emanations of the Constitution. The implication being that there are rights that are not written down, but are sort of logical implications of the rights that are written there. Now Griswold was a case about contraceptives, and I think probably a case that, looking back at it now, you won't find many people who disagree with the substance of the decision. So the court basically said use of contraceptives is a decision that should, you know, be made by the couple in the bedroom and not by the state. Certainly don't want the state enforcing those kinds of decisions, so that's part of the private realm. Therefore, the state should stay out of it. And where do we find this private realm in the Constitution? Well, again, it's this implication of it's this implication of that flows out from the stuff that's actually there. Roe versus Wade then comes along and builds on that. So again, if all we had were Griswold versus Connecticut, there would be people who objected to it, but I don't know that anyone would ever have even heard of the case until Roe versus Wade comes along and builds on that and says that not only is there the implication that we have the right to privacy, but an implication of that implication is that within that right to privacy, women have the right to have an abortion. Again, this overturns the laws of 30-some states in the country and basically breaks us into a cultural civil war that's been ongoing since then. Probably the best way to understand the abortion issue since 1973 is a combination of cultural conflict, so pro-lifers and pro-choicers marching and counter-marching in the streets and arguing against each other within the culture. And then in the political sense, Congress and state legislatures trying to find ways to get around Roe versus Wade. So we see states passing increasingly restrictive laws, not all states, of course, but many states passing increasingly restrictive laws that are intended to limit the number of abortions that happen within that state, and then Congress making various attempts at doing the same thing. The big case that comes after Roe versus Wade is Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which comes in the early 90s, 1992, I think. This was the big one. This is the one when people thought Roe might be overturned. It was the first case where you have a majority of justices who are Republican appointees on the court. I want to say it's the first case that had happened in since like the 1950s or 60s, but don't quote me on that for sure. And in this case, Roe is upheld, and the court says that abortion cannot be restricted if restricting it places an undue burden on the woman making the decision. Mm-hmm. Now, what on earth is an undue burden? Well, they don't tell us, so the attempt to restrict abortion continues. And that's basically where we're at now. There've been some sort of creative attempts to get around it. So in Texas, a few years back, Texas said, okay, well, people who work at places like Planned Parenthood claim that they are providing medical services and it's necessary for the health of women. So if they're providing medical services, then they need to be held to the same standard as hospitals and clinics. They need to have the same sort of sanitary standards. They need to have the same sort of medical qualifications to work there, which basically priced Planned Parenthood clinics out of business. That is in the courts. I believe that Texas law was overturned, but again, I haven't had a whole lot of time to follow the case of that through the courts. But again, basically where we're at is this huge conflict between the pro-choicers and the pro-lifers that is mostly cultural and occasionally political, just depending on whether it's an election year, what's going on in the political climate and so on. Mm-hmm. I think it is fair to say that that Roe versus Wade is the most important Supreme Court case of the 20th century. It basically reinvents constitutional interpretation as a discipline taught at law schools. Prior to Roe versus Wade, there were constitutional law classes, but they had a very different focus than they have after it. It again starts this cultural civil war that's been going on for 40 years at this point. It is the big one. When I teach the Supreme Court class, we spend 2 weeks on Roe versus Wade, not because it is fun to talk about abortion, but because it's just such an important case in the life of the court. All of that to talk about what happened, a little bit about what happened in the history of the issue. None of that is saying anything about the morality or the ethics of it, which is maybe where you should step in, Ed. What are we supposed to think about abortion ethically?
Yeah, so there are a number of different issues. There are issues of constitutional interpretation, which maybe you and I will actually get to in a future episode. But so to direct our attention away from constitutional issues and whether or not it counts as a good interpretation or a bad interpretation,
Can I just throw this out real quick?
Yeah.
I don't think anyone defends Roe as a good interpretation. So even pro-life jurisprudent, jurists tend not to look at that case and say this is a model of good jurisprudence.
Yeah,
I mean it's incoherent. It gets into like trimester systems, and I mean it's just it is not the model of what a case ought to be. Now I don't think that actually affects anything because very few people actually read it, but it's not the place you want to go if you're an originalist wanting to make an argument against non-originalism, or if you're not an originalist and wanting to make an argument for it. No one's going to use Roe, right? It's important because of what it does culturally, not because of what it actually says.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so to turn our attention to like the more fundamental questions obviously typically turn on the question of when does life begin? When does something become have this? So everybody would agree that murder is wrong. Why is murder wrong? Because human beings have an intrinsic kind of dignity or right to life. And then the question is, well, when do human beings attain that status? And so we can get into a lot of debates about personhood, about when life begins or when the right to life begins, when it's okay for us to end a life. And just a few different things there. I mean, the typical, I don't know if you would add on to this, but the typical argument that you always hear, the standard pro-life argument is that life begins at conception, and then the way that story is told is at the moment of conception, for the first time, you get something that is genetically unique. That thing has all the potentialities to become the full-fledged human being that will achieve, when it is born and up to the point in which, the natural life of that creature ends. It's genetically unique. That's an important point of emphasis in these pro-life arguments. For the first time in the history of the world, something appears that is unlike anything that has existed prior to that point in the world. And so biologically, for the first time, you have a human life. And because biologically you have for the first time a human life, you have something that has the right to life. Does that sound about right to you?
Yeah, I mean that's certainly the one that you hear most often. I also hear when the heartbeat starts is the other one that I hear quite a bit of as just sort of an easy line that you can draw, right?
Yeah, so that's interesting. And developmentally, when does that start to happen?
Having my wife had a baby 3 months ago, so I should know that, but I don't. I want to say it's in the first month. It's really early. Google.
So equally, people will look to the point at which the heart begins to beat, or the point at which
about three weeks.
The point at which brain activity begins, which is also sort of right around 3 or 4 weeks. It's certainly the case that when you look at pictures of developing fetuses, it starts to sort of look like a lot more than a bunch of cells pretty early on, like in the first few weeks. But that's interesting. I mean, that is an argument that I don't often hear made from pro-lifers, because it's typically pro-lifers want to draw a line in the sand right at conception and just make sort of a real clear
right. And that's obviously the safer line to draw. Right, I mean that is the one when, like you said, you have the genetic uniqueness, and when the heartbeat starts is going to be, of course, different, right? In every case, It's not like it's automatically 3 weeks after conception it happens.
Oh, sure. But so, there, I mean, there's a developmental spectrum at which these things start to...
Right. And really, I mean, the only two sort of absolute black lines that can be drawn are conception and birth. I mean, I suppose there might be more. I'm not that kind of doctor. But those are the two big ones, at least. But certainly conception and the heartbeat are the two that I hear most often from both sides, from the side of the pro-choicers, because they also have to articulate, you know, at what point does life begin and at what point do you have a right to life and so on.
Mm-hmm. You know, at the risk of making the kind of esoteric philosophical argument that drive non-philosophers crazy... but, you know, if we're talking about the moral and ethical issues, with regard to the shape and development of the debate, philosophically, one of the more important contributions in debates about the morality of abortion was written by a feminist philosopher, Judith Jarvis Thompson, in, I'm trying to remember when she wrote that article, but I think it was in the 70s. Do you know the article that I'm talking about?
It's with the violinist example. Years.
So Thompson... Thompson argues that the debate about abortion historically has turned on personhood questions, like when does the fetus become a person and so possess the the qualities that give that intrinsic kind of moral respect. And so the debate is sort of always about personhood and these, you know, the debates back and forth about when personhood begins, whether it's at conception or later. And Thompson tries to argue that actually that's beside the point, because even if we conceded that a developing fetus was a person, that actually doesn't necessarily give it the right to life. And she uses this very esoteric thought experiment, and the thought experiment goes like this. Imagine that there was a very famous violinist, like the world's greatest violinist, who had, I think it's a kind of a kidney or a blood malady. And it just so happened that the only way that violinist's life could be protected was to... You're the only person in the world. You, Coyle Neal, are the only person in the world.
What am I doing in bed with this violinist? I'm married.
Yeah, we're getting to that. You're the only person in the world who is a genetic or tissue match. And so what happens is you're knocked out. You wake up in a hospital room next to the violinist, and you are connected to him. And what's happening is that your kidneys, I guess, are flushing his blood and keeping him alive. And after 9 months of being hooked up to you, he's going to be perfectly fine. And so the question is whether or not it's morally wrong for you to separate yourself from him, given that doing so will certainly kill him. And what's interesting about the thought experiment is that there is no question in this case that the person in question has a right to life, because he's a fully developed adult. But then Thompson argues that it's obvious that while it might be really, really nice of you to stay hooked up to him and keep him alive, you're under no moral obligation to do so. Staying hooked up to him is supererogatory. And even though it's the case that he will most certainly die if you disconnect from him, then you're still under no obligation to do so. And then she argues that this is morally analogous to abortion. The question of the moral status of the developing fetus is secondary. The question is whether the fetus, even if it's a person, has a right to sustenance from your body. And she argues that that's a separate question.
And of course, in that case, you had no choice in the getting hooked to the violinist, right? So you add in... the possibility that maybe I volunteered for that, or maybe I took some action that resulted in me being hooked to the violinist, which I knew would result in me potentially being hooked to a violinist. Yeah. That changes. I should change anyway the discussion a little bit. As someone who likes science fiction, I do want to know: will I be able to play the violin once this is done?
That's the amazing thing, and you'll also be able to speak French.
Awesome.
So, you might think about that. Yeah, so it's certainly the case that most people think that if Thompson's argument proves anything, it only proves anything with regard to the morality of pregnancy resulting from rape or something like that. Because the distinctive thing about the case is that the violinist is violently forced upon you. And then a lot of people are going to argue that there are other problems with the case to begin with. Thompson comes up with other thought experiments that don't seem to involve coercion. But in any case, with regard to moral and ethical debates amongst professional philosophers, Thompson's argument is important.
Right.
But otherwise, most of the debate sort of turns on this debate about, you know, this fundamental question about life beginning.
Yeah, I might have a little bit more to say when we start talking about whether or not there's a Christian view. Like you said, this does sort of come down to when life begins, and I just don't know that we have a line that we can draw. So again, the safe line is conception, right? It certainly begins there if it's going to. I mean, it doesn't begin before that, right? So that's certainly the earliest we can draw that line. We'll talk biblically about whether or not there is anything we can use to come to that decision. As a Christian, of course, it's not just a question of when the biological life begins, but when is the person ensouled, right? When is the person both biologically and spiritually a whole person? Again, I think it is a reasonable assumption to put both of those moments at conception, but I don't really have anything that I can point to and say, everyone clearly must believe this. Which is, I mean, in some ways, that's the real break point between the pro-lifers and the pro-choicers when we're having the public discussion, right? I mean, there certainly are pro-choicers who will happily admit that we are talking about an innocent life, and we'll still support, you know, the woman's right to choose. I think those conversations are much more difficult because that, as far as I'm concerned, that is a morally monstrous position. But again, it is still a position that is held by at least some that the discussion has to be had.
I mean, I guess it depends on what the particular interlocutor that you're imagining is saying. I mean, they might well be saying that, but there are other moral costs that need to be weighed off against it. And I wouldn't necessarily, I mean, depending on the case that you're talking about, I wouldn't necessarily call that a monstrous position. But
But again, are there? So I realize that it is a complicated moral question. But at the end of the day, the intentional taking of an innocent, defenseless human life, I suppose there might be like moral issues that balance that sufficiently that you can say it's okay, but I have certainly yet to run into any.
Yeah, why don't we get to that in a second?
Right.
That's something that I want to bring up in a different context. But, I mean, so I have to say, it looks like we both agree that, like, the question turns on the question of when personhood begins, that there's a moment at which something gets a special kind of status. And, you know, so where do you draw the line? Well, you can draw the line at birth. So, you know, virtually everybody's going to want it. At the very least, birth is, you know, once a creature is alive and in the world, then at that point it certainly does. So that's...
And virtually everyone's going to say that's too late, right? So even when you're on the pro-choice spectrum, I should have pulled up the opinion polls on this, but something like 95% of pro-choicers are going to say day before due date abortions are immoral, right? I mean, so that number, the farther, the closer you get to that date, the more sort of pro-life, quote-unquote, people are.
Yeah, and then, you know, another line that you could draw that you didn't mention was viability, right? Mm-hmm. So the point at which the fetus could survive outside of the womb.
Which that's 25 weeks, is that right?
Well, I mean, it's kind of all dependent on medical technology, but yeah. I mean, the line at which...
That's 20, I think that's...
Yeah. Or, you know, you could go back to the beating heart or brain activity or conception itself. You know, it's interesting. It sounds like your way of drawing the point and your way of thinking about the morality of abortion and my way of thinking about the morality of abortion is identical. So the way that I think of it is that this is a super hard question. We know the point at which a fetus develops moral status happens before they actually enter the world.
Right.
And not like when. And, you know, I would want to say before viability. And, I mean, and to me, in some ways, like the most relevant moral point for me is sort of has to do with brain activity. But even then, it's sort of like these are really complicated moral questions. These are really serious moral questions. And then my attitude is that given the sort of uncertainty about it, the morally prudent thing to do is to err on the side of caution.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know if it's obvious to me that moral status begins at conception. But if it doesn't begin at conception, it begins, you know, soon thereafter. How soon? That's a hard question. But I certainly feel very differently about an abortion at 1 or 2 weeks and an abortion at, you know, 21 weeks. But in any case, given the seriousness of the issue and the moral stakes involved, we should sort of err on the side of being cautious. Is right. That basically how you... That sounded like how you were thinking about it.
Yeah, and again, I... So sort of intellectually, I'm perfectly happy to say, like, I don't know, right? Intellectually, theologically, mm-hmm. I don't know. And I think that is important, and we'll get back to this, because it does leave room for charity when it comes to Christians who are pro-choice. I do think I disagree with those individuals, but I think there is mm-hmm. that sort of narrow wiggle room for, because we don't know when life begins, maybe we want to err on the side of caution, but that's not the same thing as saying we should put the law on the side of caution as well, right? And I think that charity is important, although, again, I'm going to have some serious questions for Christians who mm-hmm. take that line. But again, at the same time, if you ask me what I think the law should be, yeah, theologically, morally, maybe biologically, scientifically, I'm going to say I don't know the answer to those questions. What should the law be? Well, I think the law should also err on the side of caution. Right? I think mm-hmm. that the law ought to protect as much as possible, just in case. Especially since in this particular instance, we are talking about a matter of, you know, weeks or months. Mm-hmm. In this case, it is something that there is a time sensitive nature associated with.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it sounds like we're pretty much on the same page there.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You and I have literally never talked about this until this very second.
Right.
And so so I describe my politics or position on this issue as being pro-life, but in some ways a little bit more moderately so relative to other Christians. Maybe at this point it's worth just sort of talking about some basic facts and statistics about abortion and who's getting abortion and how frequently it's happening. One thing that I think everybody is really excited about is the fact that, historically speaking, there are fewer abortions happening in the United States than at any time in which we have reliable numbers. I think that's fair to say,
at least since the early 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
Since it has been legalized, if the numbers we've got are accurate, which again it's hard to say because reporting on this is voluntary, depending on where you are, right? It's not always mandatory. And the CDC, which is at least the numbers I looked up, only collects from 47 reporting areas. I'm not sure exactly what they mean by reporting area, but it is not a comprehensive survey.
Yeah, I think certain states do not release their abortion totals.
Right.
And I'm assuming that in the Guttmacher Institute also sort of collects as a good source for abortion statistics. And I'm kind of assuming that they are making their best statistical estimations of what's going on in those other states.
Right. And again, I don't know what those – so if one of those states is California, obviously that's going to be a big –
One of those – it's California, Maryland, and New Hampshire at least.
Right. Okay. Well, again, that would significantly skew the numbers. But so what? Where overall numbers were at what, like something like 58 million abortions since 1973, somewhere in the neighborhood of that, maybe more. But in the year by year abortion, the last number I've got here is 2013.
Where are there?
Sorry, go ahead. Do you have something more recent?
Well, so I'm looking in 2015, it dropped below a million to 906,000.
Right.
And that is down from a peak of 1.6 million abortions in 1990. So that is heartening. In the last 27 years, the number of abortions has dropped by almost half. Moreover, just continue to talk about, just to get a sense of the statistics, over one-third of abortions happen in the first 6 weeks. 90% of all abortions happen in the first trimester.
Right.
Only 1.3% of all abortions happen after 21 weeks.
And I forget the number, but a more than 50%, a majority of abortions are by women who are not married, right? So it's...
Yes, yeah, that's right.
And it's significantly more than 50%. It's, you know, like 70 or 80%.
Yeah, that's right.
Although that does not... none of those numbers, I think, tell us... for any given abortion statistic, how many of those abortions are repeat? So it's the number of abortions, not the number of women who are having abortions, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen, you know, I had that statistic earlier, and I still think it's the case that the majority of abortions were had by a woman who had never had an abortion before. But in any case.
Yeah, I don't know for sure.
You know, and there's a lot of debate about what explains the decline in the number of abortions. A lot of people try to suggest that it's a result of some of the more restrictive laws that have been put in place in states around the country.
Right.
But in fact, it looks like the main reason that's driving it in is just the decrease in the number of unplanned pregnancies. There's been a precipitous drop in the number of unplanned pregnancies. And when you just look at the abortion rate for unplanned pregnancies, that hasn't really changed. So the thing that's really driving the decrease in the number of abortions is birth control, basically.
Right. Now, should we say something here about forms of birth control that might involve abortion? So our Catholic friends would want us to mention the pill.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't have the scientific knowledge to be able to speak about those things. Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about them. From what I understand, there are different kinds of pill. Some of them are abortive against, and some of them are not. I don't know one from the other.
Yeah. There's a big debate about IUDs and the extent to which they are abortifacients or... You know, and it's interesting. So neither one of us is going to talk with great insight or authority on this subject. But I do remember reading an article that was trying to suggest that for a long time, doctors didn't really know, but that, and I guess it depends on the particular medication that's used, but that the article was trying to suggest that actually that's not how it happens, and that it has to do with, it just prevents an egg from dropping.
Right.
So if a woman hadn't actually, if the egg actually hadn't descended, it prevents that from happening, and it's not, and it doesn't have to do with, but again... Yeah, those are certainly moral issues for a lot of people.
Well, and that is the difference between saying, you know, abortion numbers in the United States are down and saying abortion numbers in the United States are stable or rising, but more people are using this particular method of birth control.
Yeah.
I don't know where I fall on that issue, again, just because I don't know enough about the technology itself. Although churches that I have been... a member at both now and in the past have tended to kind of leave that up to individual conscience, which makes me think that, like you said, that the science just either isn't clear or it has come down on the it's not actually an abortion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, so that's interesting, and certainly our Catholic friends are going to have a different, or at least some of our Catholic friends are going to have different perspectives on this issue. In the end, in some ways I don't know what to say, though I... So the number of pregnancies that are going to be terminated. Let's say there is an abortifacient effect, and it's not simply a matter of preventing an egg from dropping under conditions in which it might be fertilized. That's only going to be a percentage of the number of pregnancies that would have otherwise been that would have otherwise happened.
Right.
And I'm tempted to say that other things being equal, there's probably a justification for taking birth control, even if on some occasions it did act as an abortifacient. But for me, I mean, sort of also figuring in on that gray area. I mean, you know, the life begins at conception arguments. It's kind of hard to know what to make of them in some ways. I'm certainly not fully persuaded by them. You know, I mean, it's true, yes, you have something genetically unique. And yes, it's true, yes, that you have something with all the potentiality of producing a full, you know, full-grown human being in 9 months' time. But it's not clear to me that that necessarily just equals moral status.
Well, and it's also, I said earlier, it is a black line, and that's true, but it's also, to some extent, an unmeasurable one, right? Like, you don't, without being too crass, you don't know the exact second it happens. And you don't know that it has happened for a while afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So even if life does begin at conception, we're still politically, morally, ethically talking about a time after that, right? Or our conversation mm-hmm. about the ethics of it begins, you know, a couple of weeks after or even later.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, to say life begins at conception is fine. Practically, what does that mean for the law? What does that mean for my ethical responsibilities?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that does matter if we're talking about something like a pill that acts at different times, but that's you know, it's not always the case.
So. Yeah. You and I have sort of alluded to the theological issues at stake. Maybe we should try to talk about that.
We should get back in areas we know about, we know something about.
Or at least that we can sort of talk in ways that it seems like we know about them, even if... Yeah, so, I mean, one of the interesting things here is that, you know, among evangelical Christians, I mean, I don't know what percentage of evangelical Christians profess to be pro-life, but certainly it is the vast, vast, vast majority of them. And I expect that if you asked most evangelical Christians why they're pro-life, their reasons wouldn't be sort of appealing to the kinds of secular philosophical arguments that we've been talking about, but they would be appealing to theological arguments. And they take scripture to be speaking directly to these issues. The relevant passage that most people would appeal to in the first instance would be the Psalms, and Psalm 139 in particular. That's the psalm that reads, "For it was you who formed my inward parts, you knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works that I know very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. You, your eyes beheld my unformed substance. In your book were written all the days that were formed for me when none of them as yet existed." That seems to be a very powerful statement of the moral status of the unborn that a lot of people appeal to in the first instance to try to offer a theological justification for their views about the beginnings of life. I actually think that has nothing to do with abortion. I don't know if you have thoughts on that particular passage, Coyle.
I mean, it certainly has to do with the sovereign act of God in creating each and every one of us, the authority and power and right that God has to claim our lives. Does it tell us a moment at which at which life begins? Well, yes, it tells us that it happens in the womb. But I don't think that it is. Again, I don't think that it's giving us a specific guide to.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, from this point on, ending this life is wrong. I kind of wish we did have a passage like that, because then that would sort all of this out for us, at least from the Christian perspective. But
yeah, people also cite other kinds of passages. I have to say that for me, you know, my views on abortion have been largely formed by the work of the New Testament scholar Richard Hayes. He teaches at Duke. He wrote a magnificent book, maybe it was in the late 90s, called The Moral Vision of the New Testament. I mean, to me, like, that's one of the greatest works in moral theology written over the last 20 years or so. And what's cool about that book is that he's laying out, like, a comprehensive methodology for doing New Testament ethics. And the first the first half of the book is sort of all theory about how to use scripture, well, especially the New Testament, for theological, moral theological purposes. But then it's cool, the last half of the book takes on particular moral issues. So there are really great chapters on violence. One thing that's interesting about Hayes is that Hayes is a pacifist. So there's a compelling, a really interesting chapter on violence and defense of justice. I'll just say that I'm not a pacifist, but I found reading that chapter really, really compelling with regard to sort of the amount of violence that I'm willing to tolerate in my own life. There's a really great chapter on divorce. The best thing I've read on homosexuality is in this book. And then additionally, there are chapters on antisemitism and ethnic conflicts, and a great chapter on abortion. This is what Hayes argues on abortion. He argues that no biblical text speaks directly to the issue of abortion, and he canvasses a lot of contenders that people often appeal to, and especially that Psalm 139 that I just read. And of Psalm 139, Hayes writes that, first of all, the first thing you have to do is you have to recognize the fact that the genre of literature here is poetic. And it's certainly the case that the psalm wasn't written to address debates about the beginnings of life that would happen in the 20th century. It's a poetic genre, and it's really clear that the point of the psalmist here is to address God's sovereignty, God's control, and God's control in care for us, right? So it is a psalm that is, in the first instance, using this very rich poetic language to communicate God's intimacy with us and his care and concern for us, not trying to get at issues of abortion. But then Hayes argues that there's no passage, no biblical text that speaks directly to the issue of abortion, but he does think that in general, especially when you look at the symbolic world of Scripture, God is always portrayed as being the creator and author of life. And so to terminate a pregnancy is to terminate a work of God. So he does sort of argue indirectly for a generally pro-life position. But then what's kind of interesting at the end of the chapter is that he does sort of consider hard cases in which he thinks that there might be a moral justification for abortion. He first considers the issue of... Well, the least controversial issue, I think, is when the mother's physical life is at stake.
Right.
At risk, he certainly thinks that abortion is justifiable in those cases. Most people think that. You're nodding your head, so I assume that you think that as well.
Yeah, I think so. Again, if someone were to come along and make a compelling argument that, you know, the mother's... And it's actually... I hope it's okay that I share this. It is my wife that sort of nudged me a little bit away from that when she was pregnant, pointing out how, you know, yes, maybe legally there ought to be a choice in the case of the mother's life being in danger, but it ought to be a choice rather than an assumption that therefore abortion is the next step.
Yeah,
And that it may be the case that the mother chooses to give up her own life for the life of the child.
Mm-hmm.
And that does raise that sort of interesting ethical question, like what obligations do mothers have to their children even while they're in the womb? And I am not in a position to answer that, not having thought about it, and not being a mother, and so on. But.
Yeah, and so I'm just going to ditto that. But in any case, that's a different kind of case than certainly other kinds of cases. The other kind of case that Hayes considers is case rape and incest. He thinks that while it's a tragic choice, he thinks that it's justifiable in those cases because to force a young woman, well, a woman, to bear a child born of violence in that way is to force her to undergo a kind of a trauma that she isn't obligated to undergo.
Right, and again, I am less sympathetic's not the right word, because of course great deal of sympathy is needed all around in that circumstance. Again, I would say in a legal sense that probably what ought to be the law, and I think there's probably generally a consensus that yes, in cases of rape and incest, abortion ought to be on the table. Again, I would hesitate, because I don't know that compounding rape with ending an innocent human life is you know, automatically the proper moral conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what do you think about that, Ed?
Yeah, I mean, so, I mean, I tend to sort of, I think Hayes's overall view is more or less correct. That's that's like the most obvious kind of a case. But, you know, now we can't remember if we were chatting about this before we actually began recording or whether this was part of the recording. But, like, you know, there are going to be cases in which you sort of have to, you're weighing off moral goods. And, right. And so I would say, and Hayes says this, that, like, that's a really horrible, tragic kind of a choice, but a kind of a choice that is justifiable.
I would certainly deny that abortion in that instance is a moral good. It might be a moral evil that we politically, publicly allow to happen, but again, I would not grant that any kind of moral imprimatur. It would be a sort of legally we allow this choice. Ideally, we will support you in going ahead and having the child.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would legally, I guess maybe we don't need to push this point too much, because legally, yeah, that's probably a concession that we just need to make, because that's where the culture is at. I think that still needs to be recognized as we are following up an evil action with another evil action, and we're just kind of permitting the law to do that in this case.
Yeah, you know, and so the morality of the question is different from the legality of the question. And, I mean, I don't feel great about the morality of the question. On the legality of the question, I feel a little bit better about that. I mean, just in part because, I mean, look, we know that there's going to be a gap between what is morally the right thing to do and what is legally the right thing to do. And now when we're talking about sort of using the coercive power of the state against the person, sort of for, you know, the coercive power of the state forcing a person to undergo this trauma, that particularly makes me uncomfortable. So, you know, if you were to ask me just a straight up moral question of what, if I, you know, if I were under those conditions, what I would do, that's kind of one thing. But
would you allow the woman to kill her rapist after the event is over?
No.
Even though she is still living with the trauma of that person out there in the world.
No.
That constant living reminder that this awful thing has happened.
Yeah, no. I mean, I see where your question is going, but there's obviously sort of a different... I mean, and that's horrible, obviously, right?
I don't disagree.
Especially when the perpetrator is at large or been found innocent or whatever. I mean, that's horrible.
Sure.
But... Yeah, and your point is that in both cases, it's not about the status question, and so that's fine. And then I would say, yeah, but there's still something sort of more uniquely horrible about having inside of you a life, part of whose being comes from this person who violated you in the most intimate and horrible ways.
Having inside you an innocent, defenseless life.
Yeah, that nevertheless is born of an act of violence.
Yep.
I mean, that's different, I would say. Why don't we get to the other kind of exception about which that you might find even more controversial? What about cases in which a child has a severe handicap?
Oh, I'm sorry, like are we moving on from Hayes?
No, sorry, this is still Hayes. So Hayes thinks that, in general, abortion is wrong.
Right.
He thinks that abortion is justifiable in cases in which the life of the mother is at risk. He also thinks it's justifiable, tragically justifiable, in cases of rape and incest. And then what does Hayes think about cases in which a child has a very severe handicap? And part of the tenor of the book is that, I mean, Hayes's book is very communitarian, and he thinks that the community plays a hugely central role in the moral life of Christians and the church. And Hayes suggests that a decision about what to do with a severely handicapped or disabled child ought to be addressed corporately by a local church community. And then, quote, "So the burden of the decision and its consequences would not fall upon the parents alone." So there's this communitarian aspect, and he very much sort of has this vision that you know, we live our lives in community. We live our lives as part of the church. Undertaking one another's burdens is just what Christians do. What if you lived, you're a Christian who lived in the absence of such a vital community who wasn't going to sort of support and help you care for the child? What if you lived in the absence of such a community, or you lived in a community and they weren't going to be the kind of community that was going to do what the church should do under those conditions? And then Hayes writes this: while I believe that the witness of the New Testament should have tipped the balance the other way, that is to say, in bearing the child to term, I respect the difficulty of their situation and the moral gravity of their action. In a case where the New Testament offers us no clear instruction, it is perhaps inevitable that Christians will, in good conscience, reach different conclusions. They did what they believed was right, seeing abortion as a tragic but necessary choice. If such a choice is necessary, the tragedy is primarily the burden of a church that has abdicated its calling to, quote, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ, quoting Galatians there. The New Testament envisions a more excellent way. What do you think about that, Quill?
Yeah, and again, to keep going back to this, I have not read this book, so I know nothing beyond what you've read out of it, but it sounds like that position is, at best, nonsense, and at worst, actively wicked. Because a Christian should never, ever, under any circumstances, take the position that because a child is a burden, it may be exterminated. That is, as people who have been burdensome to God, who have been bought by the death of His Son, which is, you know, without doubt, the greatest burden that has ever been borne by anyone, to turn around and say to someone else, but you are a burden to me, is functionally unconscionable.
Yeah.
Now, with that said, I agree with him about the responsibility of the church to step in and assist. Mm-hmm. That part, of course, is absolutely true. And it is obligatory on the church to especially reach out to families with, you know, special needs children and so on and assist with that. He's right about that. But to say, but, you know, if they don't, I guess you got to do what you got to do. I don't know how to say that strongly enough.
Yeah.
Because someone has a handicap or special needs, we don't kill them.
Yeah, so maybe we should clarify here about, I mean, does the severity of the handicap matter at all?
No. Ed, you and I deserved hell. There's no more severe handicap than that. God chose not to send us there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how, in good conscience, one could take that position.
So this actually sort of gets at certain kinds of issues about late-term abortions that I wanted to get at. And, like, in a lot of ways, late-term abortions are particularly horrific. I mean, they are particularly horrific.
Right.
But, I often think that when Christians or pro-life advocates talk about cases like that and the language that they use in cases like that, they often sort of seem out of step with, like, what is morally going on in those kinds of cases. And so first of all, I mean, the percentage of people who are getting late-term abortions is like, I mean, it's like literally 1-2%, right?
Right.
And why would you be getting an abortion that late in term? I mean, typically it's because the children have the most horrific kinds of physical handicaps that are imaginable. So we're not just talking about Down syndrome here, but we're sort of talking about cases of encephalitis in which the brain is forming with massive voids. I was reading this one particular case about a kind of defect in which the brain remains fused into a single hemisphere. Both eyes don't fully develop. And, you know, these are cases in which people sort of are amazed that the child had survived up to that point, and in which it's really clear to all involved that the child is going to die very early in life and sort of endure a very painful existence. So first of all, like, that's the kinds of cases that I'm talking about. Certainly not talking about what are, in comparison, I mean, I don't want to sort of underestimate like the moral significance, but I mean, other kinds of cases of cerebral palsy or
Down syndrome that are
comparatively very different. Like, really talking about like the most severe handicaps in which it's clear that a newborn isn't going to survive very long and is going to live sort of a very painful existence.
Right.
Does that matter to you at all?
It matters in the sense that as Christians, we ought to be involved in that family's life, particularly if they're believers and members of our church. So yes, it matters in that sense. Again, does that give you the ethical right to execute the child? Yeah, I think that's going to be a really hard sell ethically for me.
Yeah. I don't necessarily disagree with you on like the question of Christian morality, but what if we're sort of talking about the question of secular legality?
I'm probably going to be on the side of resisting that law as well.
Mm-hmm.
I would really hesitate to endorse that, and someone would have to make a better scriptural argument than anything I've heard so far anyway. Certainly than the bit you read from Hayes.
Yeah. I mean, again, Hayes' big point is that Scripture is directly silent on the topic. Scripture doesn't directly address the issue of abortion. Though, I mean, you know, you're certainly right.
I would push back on that, too. I mean, I think every time Scripture tells us not to kill, you know, I mean, it's in the Ten Commandments. It addresses the issue of abortion. Now, we might ask, when life begins, of course, where does that rule begin?
Yeah.
But once life begins, Scripture talks a lot about our obligations to human life.
Yeah, so in those cases of very late-term abortions, that when life begins question is kind of tabled.
Right.
That's a lot less unambiguous.
And I know of no scriptural charge to table that question when you're dealing with someone who is innocent and defenseless.
Oh, sure. And you're certainly right that the general arc of especially the New Testament, but the whole of Scripture, sort of has to deal with caring for the most vulnerable and the most needy. I guess I would say, on the question of Christian ethics, that's sort of one thing, but on the question of the coercive power of the state, and this might be an instance in which you're in my pro-life politics come apart a little bit. And maybe I'm a little bit less enthusiastic to sort of use the coercive power of the state to force women to undergo what would be a very tragic experience.
Right.
I certainly don't think that's an easy or straightforward thing.
Well, again, and you're back to that balancing of this thing will be very difficult for them. Do we then allow this other thing that is an active evil? Well, I think there clearly that we've said there are circumstances where I think that might be legally allowable. I'm not convinced this is one of them.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you wanted to add on this point, or?
No, I don't think so.
So, having waded through very difficult and challenging moral questions, why don't we talk a little bit about the politics and policies of abortion? I guess I would say, and I don't know that you're going to disagree with any of this, I guess I would say that one thing that disappoints me about typical Christian, the way that Christians do the politics of abortion, is that there's a lot less attention paid. I mean, all of the energy and attention seems to be paid on changing Supreme Court rulings and passing laws prohibiting abortion.
Getting the right guys on the bench, right?
Getting the right guys on the bench, as opposed to trying to generate a comprehensive public policy approach that's gonna, I guess, a more pragmatic approach that's gonna leave the world with as few abortions as there could possibly be. I mean, even if Roe v. Wade got overturned tomorrow, that's almost certainly not gonna change. Well, maybe you would disagree. That's certainly not going to eliminate abortions in the country.
It would kick it down to the state level, right? I mean, it would be back to that 39 and 11.
Yeah, well, you know, that's an interesting thing, actually, and what individual states would do in 2017 with regard to abortion rights. But I'm pretty sure the number ain't going to be 39 states versus 11. And when you look at national polling on the legality of abortion, it...
I would quibble a little bit, just because we have seen something of a pro-life... a nudge in the pro-life direction.
Yeah.
Largely, I think, because of social media. You know, if you're rabidly pro-choice, it is hard to be as rabidly pro-choice when your friends are putting up pictures of ultrasounds, talking about how excited they are. Just over time, by means of attrition, that has started to affect our culture. So in all of the ways, in all of the many, many ways, our culture has gone more progressive. That is one of the very small areas, very few areas, where there is some movement the other direction.
Yeah. You know, one of the more interesting sort of developments in pro-life politics over the last, well, even 5 years, has been like the rise of the secular pro-life movement, which is super interesting, right? And so these are, you know, avowedly identified skeptics about religion who are nevertheless very pro-life and are sort of increasingly active. And that's super interesting. And I think you're right. I mean, all of that has to do with... I mean, we know a lot more about fetal development, and there, you know, we have ultrasounds and 3D ultrasounds and 4D ultrasounds, and
I've not seen any. I've only seen this from the pro-life side, so I don't know that these numbers are necessarily reliable. But from the few stats I have seen, if you just ask sort of pro-life versus pro-choice, then yeah, the numbers have nudged towards pro-life, but it's still, you know, 43% to 42% or whatever. Divided amongst the country. But if you start adding nuance into that, right? So if you you start asking questions about partial birth abortion, if you start asking questions about abortion in the third trimester, then that number swings more radically in the pro-life direction, right? If you start adding nuance in and allow, you know, exceptions for rape, incest, endangering the life of the mother, right? Mm-hmm. Which, of course, when you just ask pro-life versus pro-choice, that assumption's not built in, then you're back to the 40-40. Yeah. But you start having
that's
qualifications.
True. And I suspect, I don't know if you agree with this, but I suspect that if it came to be the matter in which every state was sort of voting on what their abortion laws would be, it would be pretty free access to abortion in the first trimester, and then increasingly restrictive after that. I think the vast majority of states would allow abortion in the first trimester.
And again, I don't know. It's hard to tell under Roe. It's hard to know what the actual sort of popular feeling is, because the law is what it is, and it's been that way for 40 years at this point.
Yeah. And but in any case, you know, my broader point was just it's disappointing to me that there isn't more concern with a more comprehensive approach that is equally exercised about birth control and concern about poverty and healthcare and family leave policies. When you look at the reasons why that women give for seeking abortions, they are varied and multiple. But I mean, far and away, the majority of women who are getting abortions are people who are living in poverty. That's a huge consideration, you know. Worrying about being able to take care of a child is a huge issue. Family leave policies, you know, more robust family leave policies that would allow both the father and the mother time to take care of a newborn are certainly things that would make the care and raising of a child a lot easier. And then, you know, I mean, so, you know, we were talking about the morality of birth control, but especially when you look at the extent to which so much of the decline in abortion is related to sex education and the availability of birth control, I suppose it's morally complicated for the reasons that we talked about earlier, but I don't really understand that, given the horribleness of abortion, why Christians aren't really exercised about trying to make sure that there are as few unplanned pregnancies as possible. Do you have thoughts on any of that?
Well, and I think that is, so this is, maybe this is just me, but this is sort of the one issue where I wish Christians were more willing to compromise on that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of the issue where I'm willing to say to a pro-choicer, you know, look, here is a blank check, right? And in the payment column, all that's written is outlawing abortion, with the exceptions of the things we talked about, right? So endangering the life of the mother, rape, incest, and so on. You fill in whatever you want on your side of it, right? Anything you want, and I will agree to that. And I do wish that Christians were more sort of willing to have those sorts of negotiations, even for the things that I disagree with. I think socialized healthcare is a terrible idea, but if that's what it costs, I'm willing to pay that, right? I think many of the things that you just said, some of them I'm fine with, some of the things I disagree with. Again, whether I'm fine with them or disagree with them, I'm willing to accept them if the trade-off is abortion is ended, because it is such a horrendous evil. Because mm-hmm. it is this, you know, again, 58 million children killed in the United States since 1973. That's unconscionable even to say. So, yeah, I guess I'm sort of on board with you. Without endorsing the programs you're mentioning, I am willing to support them publicly if they lead to this political compromise. I don't think they will. I don't think the pro-choice side will necessarily go for it, but I'm at least willing to make the offer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and it's certainly the case that political people on both sides of the far right and the far left make those kinds of compromises hard to get. I mean, I imagine that if it were politically feasible, it would be relatively easy. Achieving a kind of a compromise. I think the compromise that we would get to wouldn't be your compromise, but it would be a compromise of first trimester abortions are okay, exceptions in cases of rape and incest, life of the mother, that's okay, but after that, not so much.
Right, and I would have to think about that, were the offer made. I suspect I would not be okay with that, just because first trimester is fairly far along. I mean, we're basically past all of those lines that you and I talked about, or most of those, maybe not viability, I guess, but we're past the rest of them. But again, it's also from the pro-life side, I've already given up. I mean, it is not like there's no compromise, right? I mean, I've already given up not punishing women who have abortions, right? I mean, that's not something we've really talked about. Prior to 1973, it was often not only were abortions forbidden, but there was an active punishment that went along with it. That's the sort of thing I'm willing to sort of negotiate away. So, yeah, I don't know. But again, I'm also not terribly concerned about that particular offer being made.
Yeah. In any case, that kind of compromise is certainly a superior moral situation to the one that we're in. Yeah, but I don't know the extent to which that's really politically feasible at this
point.
Right. But, well, that sort of exhausts everything that I have to say about this. Do you have additional thoughts that you wanted to...
Anything
that we didn't get to?
Maybe just briefly, since this episode is running a little bit long already, a couple of words about speaking on the issue. So, like, when you're mm-hmm. talking about abortions, I think there are... Mm-hmm. obligations on Christians, not only in what position we take, but in how we speak about it. And I think we should be very careful to distinguish our audience, if that's a fair way to put it. When we are talking to individuals who have had abortions, we sort of ought to be all grace, right? I mean, we shouldn't say that this isn't a sin. I think it is, but we should also be very clear that, look, sin has been paid for, that there is forgiveness that's offered through the cross, that atonement has been made for those who repent and believe. All of that ought to sort of season everything we say. And we ought to emphasize that, you know, it's not as if I'm not a sinner just because I've never had an abortion, right? I mean, again, that personal understanding between two people who are stuck in the same moral position relative to God's holiness, albeit for different reasons. Again, that should define where we're coming from when we are talking to individuals. And then when we're speaking publicly about it, we need to say, hey, look, we understand that these are difficult decisions. Nobody gets abortions because they're fun, you know, regardless of whether or not they're cheered at the DNC. They're not things that people do flippantly and so on. Again, grace and charity ought to define that, even as we speak publicly about the moral horror of the action itself. So again, there's that idea of we need to be speaking from a position of justice when we're addressing the issue and defending the defenseless and talking about how awful this practice is. At the same time, recognizing that we have a message of hope, right? The final say in this is not ultimately that the law is sinful. The final say is ultimately what we see on the cross, that forgiveness is held out. So I would say it's important that Christians remember that. It is far too easy for us to get on our moral high horses and forget that, no, we're also sinners and we also need forgiveness. Ed, anything to add about saying that,
no,
speaking publicly?
I think that is undoubtedly the best way to end this conversation. So we're grateful for everybody to listening to us talk about a very serious issue. Once again, if you have questions that you would like Coyle and I to address in our first anniversary episode, please do email them to us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. We're really looking forward to hearing from you all. As always, we are proud members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filipic. You can learn more about our show at the aforementioned Facebook page or on the main Christian Humanist website, christianhumanist.org. And as always, let me remind everybody to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking, ribbon of high